listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. We are all affected by our visual environment. Whether you find 24-story-high images of Manny Rodriguez exciting or oppressive may depend on a number of factors. Whether an electronic billboard shines into your window at night, or you might find flashing images entertaining or distracting. But most everyone in this room is certainly aware that there is a very live controversy in the city over super graphics and digital billboards. Tonight, as part of a panel titled How Many Billboards? Visual Rights to the City, a panel of outdoor media professionals and legal experts focus on the city's recent debate surrounding LED billboards and illegal signage, raising the notion of free speech as it relates to images on the street along the way. When we do have our Q&A tonight, we ask that you, when you do ask a question, that you make it a question. If you do have a comment, that you keep it brief so that others can also be heard. And above all, we want to have a civil conversation, so we want to keep that in mind as well. Those are the ground rules. This program, public program, is co-presented, and we are delighted to work with them, the Max Center for Art and Architecture at the Schindler House and the California Lawyers for the Arts. And I want to especially thank Sarah DeLeiden, who's been working on this to develop this program with Anne Bray from the Mac House. It's been a great pleasure to work with them. Our moderator, as I said, is artist and cultural catalyst Anne Bray, who is the director of Free Waves, a media arts organization and festival in Los Angeles. Anne has been delighting and enlightening Los Angeles for more than 20 years. She teaches public art and multimedia at Claremont Graduate University and USC. Please welcome our panel, and please welcome Anne Bray. Thank you.
Hello. Come on in. Yeah. Come on out. Hello, everyone. All right. We're glad to see you all interested in this issue and feeling that we've been thinking about this for months and we're very in sort of emotional and intense about this topic, and I'm feeling like a lot of you might also be in that range. So what we wanted to do was to sort of take and think about the issue and see if we could come to some point where do people want to be going eventually or immediately. And so I put up a group of slides for you to see as you were seated, and as you took a look at those, that there was a sequence there. One of the group was all San Paulo in Brazil, and they have eliminated all large signs, and that is the fourth largest city in the world. That's what the first group was, and they were all taken by this Tony DeMarco. It's like a pretty great sequence that you can find on Flickr if you wanted to see all of those images. Right? And then there was another group is Karen Olivier, and she's an artist that put up a billboard sequence in Houston where she photographed the scene right behind the billboard and then printed it on the billboard so that the billboard just slid into the landscape, right? And then we showed you some of the Mac Center billboards that are up right now around the city, and the flyer is available to show you where they are, and their website shows it. Then I put up a few, I would call very intense ads, just to be reminded exactly how close those ads come to our skin, our bodies, our feelings, etc. So that was the slideshow. that I'm coming at this as a public artist, so I'm very interested in how public space is used visually and feel quite sensitive to the issue and wondering if everyone feels that intensely or where you all are. So in the Q&A, we'll get to that. Wanted to look at the advertising industry in general. And what I have read is that we see an average of 5,000 ads a day per person, and that a few years ago it was 3,000 ads per day. That I read that it's a $23 billion industry in the United States, and of that it's $5 billion is outdoor advertising. That sound right? Okay, so that's the common products that outdoor billboards are used for are for cars, phones, beer, soda, and films, right? And so that's where we want to start. I have four panelists here to really bring up different aspects of the issues. And to tell you the truth, this is only part of the issues that I was thinking about tonight as a legal aspect of it, and really think about corporate free speech and individual free speech, and just taking that section, thinking that was a very large topic itself. So that's how much we're going to try to deal with tonight. On April 15th at SIARC, we're going to four more people are really going to look at the issue visually, like and about visual pollution or ecology, and how much do aesthetics and which aesthetics do we want in our face, right? So, okay, so how we're going to go is Christine Pelisek is going to start, and she's going to give you an historic background of the issue from 2000 to now in Los Angeles, right? And then Rick Robinson is going to, is general manager of McDonald Media and has done a lot of the work on placing the art on the billboards around the city, so he's been helpful to this project and is going to talk from an advertising point of view. Then John Turanian is speaking next, and he is the one that can really, from a legal perspective, talk about this free speech and corporate rights. And then I asked Toby Miller from UC Riverside, he's a professor of media and cultural studies, to really talk about the larger picture, I think, of just public space and our rights and how, what media has to do with public space. So how about Christine, do you want to start?
Sure. Hi. I'm going to be speaking about the history of billboards in Los Angeles. And the city really began trying to figure out the billboard situation in Los Angeles in 2001. Before, the city didn't keep an inventory or know how many billboards were legal or illegal in Los Angeles. And in 2001, the city council decided to start a billboard inspection program. And they wanted to monitor. At the time, they thought there was 11,000 billboards in Los Angeles, and 4,000 of those were they thought were illegal. And so the city, two of the city council members, Jack Weiss and Cindy Mazakowski, started this, wanted to start this billboard inspection program. And it was passed in 2002, but one of the problems with the ban was that it allowed these exceptions such as sign districts, which ended up becoming an issue down the road with the city. But after they passed this moratorium, a few billboard companies, Clear Channel, Outdoor, CBS Outdoor, and Regency Outdoor filed lawsuits against the city saying that the inspection program violated their First Amendment rights and it would cause them constitutional harm to have an inspection fee, which was, it was about $186 for the year. And so the city, basically, they filed a lawsuit against the city, and the city was winning in an appeal but in around 2004, 2005, the city attorney at the time, Rocky Delgadillo, decided to settle the lawsuit. And in the deal, the billboard companies had to take down 3% of their illegal billboards, and in exchange, they were allowed to modernize over 800 of their billboards. And modernize meant that they were allowed to digitally modernize 800 of their billboards. And there was a lot of protests from anti-billboard activists. A lot of people were upset because city attorney Rocky Delgadillo at the time, well, when he was running for city attorney, he received over $400,000 in advertising for his campaign. So people were angry about it. At the same time, a lot of companies were filing lawsuits against the city because they said it wasn't fair that the city gave Clear Channel and CBS such a lucrative deal when they weren't getting anything. They weren't allowed to. Smaller companies like LA Outdoor and other outdoor advertising companies weren't allowed to put up billboards, but Clear Channel and CBS were allowed to modernize their displays. And so there was a lot of lawsuits. Some of them filed lawsuits about the settlement deal, and other ones filed lawsuits saying that the city was allowing these sign districts and they were giving these rights to big companies like Clear Channel and CBS, and they weren't getting anything in return. So basically, any companies from super graphic companies to regular billboard companies were filing lawsuits against the city, and at one time there was at least a couple of dozen lawsuits filed against the city, and they were, in a lot of them, they were losing in court. So a couple of years ago, the city, a lot of the neighborhoods in Los Angeles got upset because some of the billboards started popping up, these new digitally modernized billboards started popping up in areas like Silver Lake, Encino, et cetera, and one of them went up in Silver Lake, and a lot of the neighborhood people got really upset over it. And so they went to the city council member there, Eric Garcetti, and complained, and they wanted it taken down. And it had been put up there by Clear Channel, and you know, the city really couldn't do anything because of the fact that they had this deal. And so what happened? Okay, so basically, at that same time, a super graphic company filed a federal lawsuit. And this company was called Worldwide Rush, and they were claiming their First Amendment violations. They were claiming First Amendment violations and the city's exceptions of allowing some billboard companies to put up super graphics near freeways while banning others. So there was a period between, I believe it was August of 2008 to December of 2008, that there was about 26 more lawsuits filed. And these were from super graphic companies putting up these big wraps around buildings. So basically, it's been a big, huge, litigious mess with the city. And no one seems to be happy. That's about it.
And so Christine has written up this in the LA Weekly, right? So if you want to search for that on the internet, you can find very detailed reports on this history. I also wanted to recommend KCT has covered it, and then the LA Times has some stories on it as well, if you want to see the progression, right? So Rick, do you want to answer? Oh, and he has a sort of a slideshow if it wants to.
Who's going to click it for me? Are you my click master up there? All right.
My name's Rick Robinson. Can they hear me here?
Yeah.
My name is Rick Robinson, and in an attempt to clear the room, I will tell you I love billboards. It's my life. It's been very good to me. I've worked with very many fine, hardworking individuals who made their living, and like all of us in this room, just try to get by. So I'll bring you that perspective in the best way I can. I work for a company called McDonald Media, We plan and buy billboard space all over the country for national brands, Nike, Mazda, ESPN, etc. I'm also an artist. I've lived downtown 20 years. The picture behind me is my fine art on the wall, a super graphic, which I did for free for a nonprofit group called Breathe LA. This was right across the street from LACMA earlier this year. It's even tattooed on my wrist. And this is a situation where fine art and commerce came together. I just show you this because this is where I'll be speaking from tonight as an artist and an advertising person. And I also just want to just point out that we're all here in this room because of fine art. It was the Mac Center and the generous funding they got from several sources to put 21 artists on billboards for the last month in Los Angeles. And that's what's created this forum we have right here. So I just think that hopefully that'll shape our tone for the rest of the evening. Digital LED bulletins. These are new in Los Angeles. And I thank you, Christine. Your summary, I think, was pretty accurate. You know, the billboard companies did a deal with the city attorney, the person they're supposed to do the deal with. And they did the deal, and they put them up. As you know, that they're digital images. They're super popular. You know, technology is part of our lives, and advertisers love these. And every 6 seconds or so, they change. It's a one-minute loop. So about every 6-8 seconds, it'll just switch to another still image again. One great thing about this inventory is that it's allowed the opportunity for a tremendous amount of public service to happen, not only in Los Angeles, but across the country, about 3 million in space in the last year and a half. It's been used for Amber Alerts, for most wanted situations, fugitives on the loose. It really provides a great opportunity to serve the public in terms of messaging, while at the same time offering avenues for advertisers. The other issue, which I think is the hotter one, is the walls. In certain parts of our city, there's a tremendous amount of demand to repurpose architecture into advertising, not just in Los Angeles, but all over the country and in the top 10 markets. It's very effective, and advertisers want it. There's a tremendous amount of demand pressure to create the supply. And with technology, it's very easy to print it and put it up. So what was once the east wall of a Hollywood office building comes alive with adhesive vinyl. You know, some people really, really love these. I think in the right neighborhoods, they make a lot of sense. Other people feel very strongly about it. If anything, it proves they cause a reaction. 24/7. You know, with out-of-home media, which is the technical advertising term for billboards and walls and super graphics, with the advent of digital printing, you can really create something that wasn't there before. Here's an example from a BART station in San Francisco, where on the left is a tunnel that was just a bland sort of antiseptic tunnel. And on the right, it's executed for Monterey Bay Aquarium, for the Tunnel of Love, for their seahorse exhibit. Believe it or not, seahorses are very amorous. And, you know, this is a great thing. It created a ton of money for BART, you know, help offset the cost of running BART for the writers. The writers loved it. This got a ton of great response. So it shows that there's situations where this can be very positive for everybody in a win-win across the board. And just some other examples where images repurpose things. This, a bull becomes a New York Ranger. The King Tut exhibit, a big super graphic. Well, this didn't show all these little figures, huh? You know, what happens with outdoor and out-of-home media, no matter what, it creates publicity, visibility, and spectacle. Whether you're the advertiser, whether you're, you know, reporting on it, whether you're legislating it from a political point of view, it gets attention. And that's what it's there for. And that's why all these people in the room reacting to it. You know, it also is an industry that creates a lot of jobs and it creates a lot of revenue. You know, the property owners get revenue, the people who work on them, you know, and it's not only a white-collar profession, but most of the labor is union and blue-collar. The people putting up the signs, the people printing the signs. There's a lot of commerce that happens with it, and we are in a capitalist society, and there is pressure to advertise. The bottom line is that we all live in the people's space, and the point of view of my agency and myself is that there is a way to find harmony with this, and I really think there's four tenets to it. You know, one of them is that we have to continue to fight as an industry for the best creative product on the street. All of us love seeing the Apple iPod ads, you know, much more than a big giant retail ad with a price tag on it. And we do fight for that and try very hard to put the best work up there from an artistic point of view. We also have to continue to push for public service, just like the examples I showed for PSAs on the LEDs, and then, sorry for all the acronyms, and the Mac Center program with all the artists. I think the industry should continue to support that and continue to allow part of that visual voice to be there for the public and the public only, along with, you know, safe and quality construction of the structures and what goes on the walls and super graphics. And then finally, find a way somehow to end the litigation. You know, it's been tough. I mean, you know, as Christine noted, there's been a long journey from the city, and it's created, you know, some people feeling they didn't get a fair shot, so they're going to fight it. I mean, litigation is part of commerce in America, part of business. Every major company has a giant corporate counsel budget, and it gets fought out in the courts, and it gets fought out publicly with this medium. So that's the point of view of myself and our company, and I'll hand it over to the next fellow here. Thank you for your time.
Cue for John to pick it up.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here. And I won't talk too much about litigation, so it's not to bore people. Talk about some of the more broad legal issues that are facing the whole issue of regulation of billboards. I wanted to start out a little bit about talking about the various approaches to sort of perhaps fighting or questioning sort of the hyper-corporate culture and the inundation of semiotic signs that we face in our cities these days. And a couple of the more innovative examples of sort of reacting against this. One of them is a guy named Reverend Billy, who I don't know if any of you have heard of him. My fellow panelist Toby knows of him. He's Reverend Billy is a minister of what he calls the Church of Stop Shopping, and he goes out and performs exorcisms of registers at Starbucks. Very amusing, entertaining guy. Every Starbucks apparently has a section in their employee manual devoted to what happens if the Reverend Billy shows up at your Starbucks. What to do? He comes with the full chorus that gives him alleluias and amens, and he praises us to move away from the shopping and our obsession with consumer culture. So that's certainly one approach. Another approach is, of course, the famous Billboard Liberation Front. I don't know if any of you are familiar with their work, but they're an organization that goes out and in some people's eyes, adds to billboards, and other people's eyes does something terrible, which is trespass by defacing billboards. So they may take billboards from AT&T, ad that says connecting to the world, and they'll add a little additional segment that says and to the NSA and wiretapping. You know, for example, as a mechanism protest. But all of those various issues have trespass, all these various reactions have trespass issues, and they are sort of in your face and aggressive. And one of the things that's really interesting about the Mac Center and what they've managed to do is they've managed to take corporate speech and fight it in a different way, not with trespassing, not with something illegal, but rather by taking speech and giving speech back in a different way, giving a voice to artists. By using the billboard not just simply as a way of transmitting corporate messages, but also using it as a way to transmit other aesthetic values, other cultural values, or other messages. And I think that's very innovative because, in a sense, they're fighting the speech with more free speech rather than trying to shut down someone else's speech. And I think it's a very effective mechanism, and I encourage all of you guys who haven't seen the billboards to go out and see the billboards and enjoy them because it is a fantastic strategy. So I'm going to just set out my couple biases at the outset so you know where I'm coming from on the billboard issue. I grew up in the state of Hawaii, which actually has had the longest ban on billboards of any state in the union. No billboards since 1927. So I remember as a kid coming out to the mainland, what we call this place, and looking around and going, wow, the cities really look different here. Now, Honolulu is still a big city, but one thing that always popped out at me was the presence of billboards. And I do remember having a guttural reaction going, oh, billboards, they seem to be, defacing the skyline. And it brought up images of urban blight. And there was certainly a predisposition to think of them negatively. On the other hand, I'm a huge supporter of the First Amendment and private property rights. And so in my own self, what I feel is kind of the clash that occurs when you start thinking about this issue legally, where on one hand you have a view of the right of communities to have some kind of say in the aesthetic value of their place, clashing with two values of the corporations. Number one, their private property rights. And number two, their potential free speech rights, their rights to actually engage in speech. So I'm going to dissect those issues a little bit, just to lay the groundwork for maybe more discussion on the legal issues facing billboards. So the first issue is private property rights. Why do I bring that up? Well, one of the issues with billboards, of course, when you start regulating them or even outright banning them, is what to do about all the billboards that currently exist. And one of the big issues that comes up there is a constitutional issue. It's called the Takings Clause. It's a little part of the Constitution and the Fifth Amendment that basically says government can't take property without providing for just compensation. It has to be done for public use, and they have to provide just compensation. There's an argument to be made that if one goes out and bans billboards, then all the people who have bought leases on these billboards or on the properties for billboards are entitled to some form of just compensation. So there is an expense associated potentially with the banning of billboards. And moreover, there's the value of regulating someone's property rights. Now, the second big issue is, of course, the First Amendment issue. What about the right to speech? And billboards do communicate. They give messages, albeit oftentimes they are commercial messages. They are messages nevertheless. Now, in previous centuries and in previous decades, that wouldn't have meant much. It wasn't until 1976, actually, the Supreme Court recognized that there is such a thing as commercial free speech. Not until 1976. Until 1976, governments could regulate speech as long as it was commercial, any way they wanted. That wasn't seen to be real speech. Courts felt that the First Amendment was really about protecting political dialogue and cultural dialogue, not necessarily, you know, pricing information. And there was a famous case about a ban in Virginia on drug prices that went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court struck the statute and said, you know what, knowing pricing information for your drugs is just as important as getting information about a political candidate. Maybe, but it deserves protection. It's still free speech. And so since then, you've had courts increasingly give protection to speech that is commercial in nature. And obviously, this is of critical importance to billboards because most billboards are commercial in nature. So starting with 1976, billboards got some kind of quasi-constitutional protection. Now, as a matter of sort of the case law goes, it's seen as lower level protection to what's called core political speech, like, you know, talking about campaigns or elections or political issues. But nevertheless, they get some level of protection. And in recent years, this has expanded even further. Probably many of you are familiar with a recent Supreme Court case called Citizens United, which caused a bit of an uproar. President Barack Obama brought it up in his State of the Union address, where he chastised the Supreme Court. Well, the Supreme Court recently voted in Citizens United to recognize corporate free speech rights in the courses of campaigns and therefore struck campaign spending limits against corporations. And to some people, this was a historical deviation from hundreds of years of case law. To others, it was a strong victory for the First Amendment for all, whether individuals or corporations. But one can see the courts are becoming more and more favorable to this notion that corporate speech deserves protection. Now, there are arguments against it. The idea of a corporation as an individual is a controversial proposition. It's something that was invented willy-nilly by the Supreme Court in the late 19th century, and some, according to some, in an accidental actual opinion that later became enshrined as it was cited again and again by the courts. And it's certainly problematic because corporations are certainly different than individuals. They don't die. They can go on perpetually. They certainly have much more political capital, much more economic capital than any one individual ever could. And so there are significant concerns once you give corporations rights that they can effectively trounce any kind of individual free speech rights. So those are two issues with respect to the side of sort of the billboard owners. And then, of course, the strong countervailing interest, legally recognized also, is the right of communities and of local governments to regulate health, welfare, morals, and even aesthetic sensibilities in their communities. Obviously, we have zoning laws, right? Well, do those take people's private property? Yeah, they do. They restrict people's private property rights in all sorts of ways. Yet, I think very few people would argue there should be no zoning laws in the United States or no zoning laws in Los Angeles. Otherwise, you'd have much greater urban sprawl than you see today. Now, of course, there is a city. I think Houston is the one city that has no zoning laws, but none of you guys are planning on moving there, I assume. So that's certainly a big issue. And courts have recognized the ability to regulate billboards on the grounds of aesthetic sensibilities, and also to protect safety. There have been arguments made that billboards, especially of the LED high-resolution variety, can distract drivers, much in the way that maybe being on your cell phone is. Some studies have suggested otherwise. It's still a proposition that people are debating. But that's another potential basis for regulation of billboards. And sort of that's the clash of the issues, and I'm happy to speak more about that as we have a dialogue on this. But that's sort of the state of the law.
Complicated, yes. Okay, so I wanted to bring up one more, the big picture issue, which is really this thing about public space, and maybe it's the same perception, but not just from a legal perspective, but more from a cultural perspective. So, Toby?
Right, I'm going to follow Rick and speak up there. So I hope you can hear me okay from here. Right. First of all, I just want to thank Mac and FreeWaves and the library for having us. I think it's great to be here. I have 11 things to say and one product placement. This is my latest book. It's about television, and it's fantastic. Is anybody here interested in television? Nobody. Anybody ever watched television? So, well caught, sir. Good play. So I want to take, if you like, a rather ambivalent, ambiguous perspective between the polarities that I think we encounter, a lot of us, in our own thinking and in others, when we address the question of, for example, digital billboards. And I think those are to do with the profound ambivalence and ambiguity that exists in commercial culture more generally, and the way that advertising does and doesn't connect to politics, does and doesn't connect to cultural expression. Rick gave us examples of fascinating artifacts that could be deemed to be cultural and commercial at the same time, as well as giving us instances that he thought weren't cultural. Christine gave us instances where politics and the law mesh together with commerce in incredibly complicated and contradictory ways, and obviously John's told us a lot about how this fits into our constitutional framework. Well, if you think about three of the biggest names in contemporary English literature, I'm thinking of Fay Weldon, Peter Carey and Salman Rushdie, one thing they have in common is that, of course, they were all copywriters. They all worked in advertising. Anybody heard the expression naughty but nice? Right? This was invented by Salman Rushdie. It was on billboards all around Britain when I was a child in the 1970s to advertise these oozing, kind of almost pustulating cream cakes, which I had to resist in order to retain my girlish teenage figure. And there are some other arguments I can make, I suppose, in favor of crass commercialism as far as it manages to sustain interesting countercultural practice. For example, there are quite a lot of countries around the world that have tried to sustain their film and television industries against gringo cultural imperialism, that's you, and nowadays me, and they've done so through policies such as quotas protecting the making of commercials, by ensuring that commercials were made in their own countries to go on their own television sets, and that they often, in often cases, had original designs generated, they were able to keep those production sectors, those artistic sectors, alive. Now, think of neon. There are some people for whom neon may not have been important. For me, and for many that I knew, neon was one of the things that helped us learn to read. Neon signs were ways in which we could point to stuff out there through the car window or through the bus window that we didn't understand and have people explain to us. Not only that, neon in a bizarre way helped to represent the idea of the city as a beacon, as a potential escape from the horrors of suburbia, in my view, and the horrors of rural life, in my view, things I really hated. Neon was an index of difference, that semiotic clutter that John was talking about, in its more positive sides. And people actually do like this stuff. For instance, thinking about the digital billboards, witness the responses that folks gave when Ashton Kutcher used digital billboards in his Twitter contest with CNN. But, as John explained, this is on the other side of the ledger, the expansion of the First Amendment to cover Mammon, to allow corporations commercial speech rights, when these should be political and cultural rights for individuals and for social movements, is an appalling instance of the way that this country has been commodified and governed head to toe by capital. Fortunately, when we look at a lot of the history of advertising law, we see that activists from both left and right actually prefer pornographers to billboard companies. Sorry about that, Rick. Why? Because civil rights groups, who often push for an expansion of the First Amendment, associate these companies with corporate power. On the other side, reactionary foundations, which push for the other kind of expansion and sometimes limitation of the First Amendment, see them as much too interested in an expansive application. So they're often really rather alone when it comes to high courts. And fortunately, there are other great counter-projects. Let's turn to art again, to think not only of Mac, but of urbanscreens.org. Anybody been there? This initiative in Amsterdam, which is terrific. In the UK, the BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation, coordinates outdoor film screenings, outdoor football broadcasts, outdoor art shows, all done digitally. In Linz, there's Ars Electronica. In Melbourne, there's Federation Square. Or think of the fun of personal multimedia messaging services, as they are inelegantly called, that place passers-by on billboards. Zhang Gar's Times Square People's Portraits. Anybody see the People's Portraits that Zhang Gar did in Times Square in New York? Or if you just walked past, your image could suddenly appear on the big screen. For all the world, a throwback. Anybody remember the Judy Holliday film It Should Happen to You from the mid-50s, right, where she's with Jack Lemmon, Peter Lawford. She wants to become famous. She wants to become notorious. She wants to become a celebrity. And so she buys herself a billboard in Midtown Gotham. And also, I quite love a lot of the super graphics. I wish they'd been around in the very drab part of Manhattan where I lived for 11 years. I used to go to Chelsea to look for them. But of course, these were super graphics done by artists. The corporate ones were, well, obvious and poorly designed. And then there are the safety issues, which John mentioned, which really are unresolved. The outdoor advertising industry has found a few coin-operated academics. By the way, I am a coin-operated academic, if anybody would like to hire me. The outdoor advertising industry has found a few coin-operated academics to announce that digital ads don't affect driving safety. But those studies have actually, in most cases, failed peer review. And have any of you seen the driver reaction in Russia when an LED board was infiltrated and hardcore porn was put up, right? You can see the driver engaging in a certain wiggling of the wheel, shall we say. This summer, the federal government is concluding some research into what they call, and this is wonderfully Orwellian, off-premise changeable message signs, right? Basically, the feds are trying to summarize all the research that's been done all over the world and do some of their own on the safety literature. The summary so far, and they've released some interim findings, illustrates, dare I say, illuminates the fact that the current state of knowledge on this topic is inconclusive. And this brings us to a huge safety distinction that applies here that is part of the difference between the way we regulate safety in this country and the way safety is regulated in other first world countries and in many third world countries. Namely, in the United States, and this applies to things like pharmaceuticals too, the presumption is until you can show harm is caused, assume no harm is caused. Regrettably, that's not how the Japanese and the French and the Germans and the Australians think you should keep your citizenry safe. And this is yet one more example of the expansion of what may well be a very unsafe advertising medium before we've actually got the scientific data in for us to make rational decisions. I've almost finished. There are also, of course, aesthetic issues. There are the NIMBY complaints, the not-in-my-backyard complaints. There is opposition to a homogenizing corporate culture. There is a sense of the compromising of architectural history. And there is also that very complicated, oxymoronically named highways beautification legislation that we have, which at least does something for all its bizarreness about the obscenity, the danger, and the irresponsibility of a car-based nation. And then there is our own LA question, which we've been skirting around tonight, of LA dirty politics, with our disgraceful roll call of electoral dingbats who lurch like drunken ex-GIs in a film noir movie between A, taking money for their campaigns, B, turning blind eyes while being chauffeured past digital boards, and C, moralizing about the need to keep the city beautiful. And what about privacy? Again, there's another side to the positive picture I painted of Zhangga and those images in Times Square. Another side to the Judy Holliday movie. Anybody here seen Minority Report, the Tom Cruise movie? Well, you may remember one of the sequences in Minority Report where there was a billboard that could use biometric systems, which, by the way, are not nearly as good as the corporations who vend them claim, but nevertheless have some uses. There are currently test form at the moment, biometric systems being used as per Minority Report so that billboards can identify pedestrians as they walk by, classify them by race, by age, by gender, and then hawk to them items that are supposedly of interest to their demographic cohort. Right? It's a far cry from the image rights issue that Judy Holliday's character faced in the 1950s. And finally, it's been suggested that each digital billboard uses enough carbon to power a dozen homes. So every digital billboard initiative should come with an environmental impact statement that flashes along with it. And if you want to know why, visit my blog at greencitizenship.blogspot.com, where I cover the carbon footprint and polluting history of the bourgeois media. Thank you.
Is it complicated enough yet? No. Okay, the issues that didn't get covered. Do you have questions for each other that you were thinking of? No? Okay, then we're going to open up in a moment, but I was wondering, Christine, whether you felt like the media has been covering this issue from, you know, consistently, or is it, it seems like it's much more in the air these days, and I was wondering, maybe even Rick, you know the answer, of how the LA reports to itself what about this issue of billboards.
Well, I think it's been reported a lot, and there's been a lot of reasons for it. I mean, there's been so much litigation out there, and so different newspapers have been covering the litigation. There's been huge mistakes by politicians, like, for example, with the city council when they decided on this to modernize the billboards. I did a story a couple of years later, and I talked to the city council members asking them, you know, why they voted for this deal, and they didn't know what digital modernization was. And it's been a field day for reporters when it comes to this, you know, this topic. Right. And so I think that a lot of, you know, the LA Times has been on it, and we've tried to get on it. So if that answers your question.
Yes. it feels like that your story and the LA Weekly sort of has inspired more stories.
I don't know about that. I just think that there's been a lot. I mean, the reporters at the LA Times, I mean, we all compete. And so there's one of the reporters, David Zanheiser, who handles it, and he's on top of it all the time. And he works City Hall, so anything that has to do with billboards, he's on top of. You know, I try to do the same thing. But there's just been so much out there with the city and, you know, the billboard inspection program. I mean, they still don't have a billboard inspection program after, I mean, when was it? They wanted to do it in 2001. It's 2010. They still don't have a billboard inspection program. So there's always something to report on.
Okay, and next question I have for John is that one thing that seems to inspire the litigation is this thing of that billboards are allowed in one part of the city and not the other. And I was wondering if you could explain further why, you know, what are the two sides to that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, part of that is forced by the constitutional jurisprudence on this. You know, when you start, you're given lesser scrutiny if you actually limit something rather than ban it outright. And so, okay, if we assume that billboards are a form of speech, then government can come in, and if they ban it, they're going to have to give much greater justifications than if they simply regulate it and limit it. And the term in constitutional law for that is reasonable time, place, manner restrictions. And courts have allowed government to come in and implement reasonable time, place, manner restrictions with sort of lesser scrutiny. So, for example, you know, there's no denying that all of us have a right of free speech. However, that doesn't mean that you can run in through a courtroom during the middle of a session and yell what your political preferences are, right? That's considered disruptive to the court. And so courts say, well, look, that's not your First Amendment's rights are being limited, but that's not unconstitutional because you can give your speech in a public park and no one's going to stop you. You have alternate forums for your speech. And so one of the reasons that that legislatures and municipalities, when they regulate billboards, what they need to do is in order to escape sort of being seen as creating an outright ban, they basically say, well, look, we'll have billboards. We'll allow billboards. You can have your free speech, but you can only have it in certain areas. And in a sense, this is a little bit akin to, for example, zoning laws that say, well, you can have only certain types of businesses in certain areas, right, if they involve heavy machinery. Or, for example, ordinances that say all the strip clubs or adult industries have to be in a certain part of town. Those generally have not been considered unconstitutional because although they do regulate the speech of someone, you still have a communication outlet. And so in that case, what the courts are saying is, and what the legislatures are trying to do is say, look, billboard companies, you can do your speech, but you got to do it in these parts of town so that we're going to have areas where that speech is allowed and we're going to have areas where that speech isn't allowed, which is really not that different than zoning laws that say, look, this is an area that's residential only versus this is an area that's, you know, commercial or industrial.
Comment.
Yeah.
You know what? The situation, though, is that it's just not that clean, you know. There's overlay zones, there's BIDs, there's all kinds of layers. And so you're told by one jurisdiction, you can go do it here, and then you get there and you can't. And trying to figure it out is I can't, you know, it's I don't know what the answer is. So, like I said, with the demand pressure from advertisers on there and with commerce to happen, people are going to try to find ways. And sure. When it's not clear, we get in the situation we're in the city of L.A. You know, I would offer up the city of West Hollywood model because in 96 they wrote the Sunset Specific Plan. You know, billboards are part of the strip. And they went in there and they did it in a way that was very clear, was very evenly enforced, that allowed the property owners to rebuild signs in better, safer ways, also put limits on it, but it allowed everything to work. And when you go there as an outdoor company, and I'm not an outdoor company, but we buy it. I did work for an outdoor company for many years, and I was involved in writing that legislation. When you go in there, you can go to the city planning department, and it's very clear. And it happens, and the property owners can prosper. The billboard companies can do what they do. The city doesn't have to spend all this money litigating it. It's easy. But when you try to do it in the city of L.A., it's a Rubik's Cube, you know. And then one person gets treated one way, and then another entity gets treated another way.
Well, and that raises serious constitutional concerns because then you've got the issue of are they taking content into account? Are they discriminating between one person and another, or one group and another group? And that then subjects them to heightened constitutional scrutiny, and that becomes an even greater problem. So municipalities need to take care to have very clear standards. Standards that are applied equally across the board, and in particular, sort of in the parlance of constitutional law, you want it to be content neutral. You don't want to discriminate between one type of company versus another type of company. So that's important in order to make your laws pass constitutional, muster.
But how do they say no smoke? You know, no cigarette ads.
Well, those have been problematic in some ways. I mean, those have been challenged. They've generally been upheld, but they've been subject to heightened scrutiny. Because, you know, you are targeting specific type of content, namely cigarette ads. So there have been a lot of problems with those.
And those were voluntarily removed from
correct.
The
they were part
business.
Of a settlement agreement also.
In
yeah.
96.
In return, yeah, there was part of a settlement agreement where the states and the federal government dropped their class action suits against the cigarette companies. So the cigarette companies got something for effectively giving up whatever First Amendment rights they may have had.
By the way, as a matter of interest, at the same time as that master settlement was struck, the Hollywood studios agreed that they would reduce diminish product placement of cigarette smoking in their movies, since which time it's gone up by 11%.
Wow. I'm just glad it's not on a billboard.
So I was wondering if you had more comments to say about the LEDs and...
Well, you know, I am, and this again speaking as Rick Robinson, you know, it's, again, I know I sound like a broken record, but it goes, the stuff isn't going to get built unless somebody wants to buy it. And so the outdoor company said, look, this technology is here. You know, we want to try to make it happen. They made the deal with the city attorney. I'm not sure who else they were supposed to make the deal with. And, you know, because of the adversarial situation there, you know, every both sides push to the extreme. And, you know, no doubt, I think, you know, some of that inventory probably isn't the perfect place it should be in. But the thing is that they're not going to be allowed to take one down and move it to another place that makes sense because the city will be punitive and say, okay, it's gone forever. So there's this, you know, this situation that doesn't really allow it to work. You know, so they just take their stance and say, we know it's in this, you know, this spot that people aren't liking, but we've made our deal, we have the right to have it there, and we're not taking it away. You know, because we have a business to run, and we're reporting to our shareholders, and, you know, so everybody's really kind of out for themselves on it. And, you know, it goes back to just all of this comes from this polarized situation. And I think that there is a place where LEDs make sense. You know, I agree with you, the research that has been done, there's, you know, every side has their research. You know, it's like in a court case. Everyone can bring in their expert who says what needs to be said to promote their point of view. You know, but in general, I would offer on the point of is it safe or not, you know, we have to take responsibility for driving the car when we drive a car. I mean, if all of a sudden you're going to blame the billboard for distracting you, then I could also blame a person of the opposite sex wearing something attractive across the street and say, you pulled my eye from me. Or I drove by a sports car that got my attention. I mean, where does it stop? You're driving your car, be responsible for driving it. But the bottom line is that, you know, at this point, you know, there isn't research that says it's dangerous. And so the industry's going forward. I think if they knew it was, they wouldn't do it. Nobody wants that liability. You know, and it makes sense. It makes sense, I think, in commercial districts. You talk about zoning. You know, if they could put it all in the places that are zoned for commercial, it would happen. But it's not made that easy. It's not like, hey, go ahead and put them in all the places that are zoned heavily commercial. So they're going to fight to put them where they can. I think they'd rather have them all in the places where it is commercial. But there's a fight over it. So then both sides just try to get what they can.
Do you think it's Los Angeles, where there's commercial streets, but then the residential is immediately adjacent? So in other cities are laid out differently, so the residential is quite separate from the commercial, sure. And here we're much more integrated.
Well, that's for sure. I mean, the zoning in L.A. hasn't been perfect, to say the least. Drive down Pico.
Right. Toby, did you think about visual blight or this visual pollution, that term? And
yes, and of course, I can understand all the criticisms that come to many of us when we think about the number of commercial messages we're sent in a given period, when we think about the sense of being overwhelmed, when we see a loss of the beauty, the aesthetics, the natural qualities and the architectural built environment qualities of our cities as a consequence of high commerce. But I get a little worried when concepts like pollution and environment are metaphorized to the point where they can really become, in my view, very reactionary ways of circumscribing what counts as art. And I don't subscribe, therefore, to that kind of metaphorization. Frequently, when you read, for instance, elaborated popular versions of this, Neil Postman wrote a famous book, anti-advertising book called Amusing Ourselves to Death, sold 250,000 copies. Neil Postman's idealized better time was before television, before cinema, before computing, before printing, when only white men who owned property got to vote and got to speak and got to write. And Neil Postman's books were things that he dictated to secretaries who then had to type them up so that other working people had to enter them so that they could then be created as books that could be sold and he could make money. So I'm very sceptical of that idea. I'm writing a book at the moment called How Green Is This Book? right? Where one of the deals we've got with the publisher is that they're going to try to work out the precise environmental load generated by the book from the get-go to the end. You know, from our own power use as we write the thing through to when it's shipped around the world to the millions of people like you who don't buy it. And I think that's the kind of environmental issue we need to be thinking about when we're pondering digital billboards, not the idea of visual blight, because I think the aesthetic question is more complicated than that, but rather the fact that the media industries, including outdoor advertising and probably including the digital area, are actually making massive impacts on our carbon footprints in this country and in this city, and those are the things that we need to be thinking about just as seriously as these aesthetic questions, if not more so.
Right. So how about if we open it up to... We have a mic that's going to come to you with your question. There's hands around. Yes, how about right behind, right there? Yeah.
Hi. Can you hear me? This is a question for Christine. I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you had, the Weekly had to sue the city to release a list of the locations of billboards, and that maybe a year or two ago the city was ordered to release the list, and you got a list of about 4,000 locations. If you could just, you know, correct me where I'm wrong and let me know the current status of public knowledge about the list of where these billboards are.
Well, we published the list. It took us, I wrote a story, I guess it was back in 2008, called Billboards Gone Wild. And one of the things that I wanted to get from the city was I wanted to find out how many billboards there were and whether and how many of those were illegal. And so I went to the city and I asked them for the list, and they said, no, we can't give you the list. And I said, well, why? And they said, well, we can't. And they ended up contacting Clear Channel and CBS and told them that we wanted to get the list. And so I got a call from Clear Channel's attorney saying, why would you want the list? And we were like, well, why not? You know, why can't we? You know, they said that they were, they said that they couldn't give the list because it was
proprietary.
Thank you. They were saying that it was proprietary, so they didn't want us to have the list. And so we ended up talking to the city attorney because they said that we should get the list. And it was kind of going back and forth. The building and safety department said they weren't allowed to give the list because the city attorney's office said they weren't allowed to. And then the city attorney's office said, yes, it was okay, they could. And so it was kind of going back and forth, so no one really knew what was going on. And so we ended up having to file a lawsuit to get the list. And so our lawyer went in there with the city attorney. So we actually worked together and to get this list, and they were fighting back and forth and whatever. So they finally gave us the list, but it was kind of a redacted list, and it was really difficult to figure out what was going on. And also they listed the locations, but they didn't say which ones had permits and which didn't have permits. And that was kind of the big question, right? We knew that there was tons of billboards out there, but we wanted to know which ones were, you know, had permits and which ones didn't. So the list didn't give us that information, so we had to go through this whole thing in order to just get this list, which really didn't give us any information. I mean, it did give us, you know, the addresses, so we ended up publishing the addresses and stuff. And since that day, I mean, I've talked to the building and safety department just recently asking them what was going on, and they said that they still haven't done the inventory, and they said what they were doing was that they were walking the streets. I said, well, what about that list? Are you going to be using the list? They said, no, we're not going to be using the list. So they're actually going down every street to find out where the billboards are, and it's difficult because some of the billboards were built in the 40s, and they're not exactly where they're supposed to be and all this kind of stuff. So it's been a difficult task for them, and it's taken, well, what is it now, 9 years to do it?
And there were 3 inspectors for that.
Right. Well, they have, well, I kind of feel bad for the building and safety department to a certain degree because of the fact that, I mean, they really have, when you think about it, they have 2 inspectors for the entire city, and it's just
not just looking at billboards, what you think of as being a billboard or a super graphic. They deal with everything, like the on-site signs, which are like the McDonald's signs. I mean, if you look at, you go to Koreatown and you look at all the signs there, you have two guys dealing with the entire city. So you can understand, you know, it's a huge job for them. So, you know, I try not to give them too much grief about it.
Do you understand why there are only two inspectors?
Well, back in 2002, when this all came about and Jack Weiss wanted this inspection program, they apparently wanted to hire about 20 or 30 guys, and they actually did hire them. And Clear Channel and CBS ended up suing, and so the program was, you know, pushed back, and so they ended up moving the people to different locations within the city and stuff like that. So, right?
Okay, hold on one sec. So we're going to follow up right here.
Before I ask my question, the reason there are so few inspectors is because the billboard settlement that Rocky Delgadillo brokered allowed only for a $186 permit fee every 3 years. So it's $61 a year for these billboards, some of which are bringing in thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars each month. But my question goes to the issue of property rights. We talked about, and I wanted to get out a tissue about the property rights for the advertisers and the billboard signage. But there's no mention about this notion being applied to the private property owners adjacent to the sign, some of whom are single-family homes, condominiums, and some of our neighbors who have digital billboards in their backyard have seen diminished property value and have had an experience of taking of property values and rights without any opportunity for a voice. Similarly, the whole billboard settlement was made behind closed doors without a single public hearing, without a single meeting of the city council discussing its terms, and we as citizens of Los Angeles had zero rights, no rights. So I would wish to have the legal question applied to citizens, sure, as well as corporate spokespersons and companies, and to have a reasonable discussion about what about us and what about the communities. When the digital billboards appeared in our neighborhood, there were no permit postings made. There were no hearings by any planning commission or area planning commission or zoning administrator. And yet, when we filed appeals challenging those digital signs, we had to go out and post notices and send hearing notices to residents within 500 feet and on and on and on. Sure.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a very valid point. That kind of goes into the zoning aspect that I was talking about, which is the communities have a right to determine the not just the aesthetic sensibilities of their area, but also zone for a variety of purposes, including, you know, as I mentioned, the example of sort of, you know, restricting certain types of industries. Well, that's partly because you don't want economic, you don't want depreciation in property values, and to protect also the aesthetic value that people bought their homes for, and to protect that. So that's actually a critical point. I mean, there are these countervailing property rights of the adjacent neighbors. I think one of the problems is you kind of get a classic public choice problem here, where you basically have one corporation with a very strong interest in having these advertisements. Then you have lots of disparate community members, all of whom bear the burden of what might be called a nuisance. But because they all have a small burden placed upon them and it's disaggregated, there's this public action problem in terms of getting them organized. And I think it's good to fight back with that by getting these people organized. And but the American jurisprudence system historically is not that great at following up on these nuisances. On issues like that, they tend to the system tends to protect more concrete, clearly defined property interests rather than sort of more ambiguous notions of nuisance that may generally befall a community. And that's maybe a broader critique of the legal system as a whole.
This is mainly directed to John, but also the rest of the panel. John, I wanted to see what your legal and maybe personal opinion is on what District Attorney Drutanich is doing, arresting property owners and arresting billboard companies and having serious bail and throwing people in jail and things like that, which is something I've never seen in the outdoor industry or in a city in my life. And it's kind of an interesting way of approaching it. And and he's, I know that they're also suing all the number of the super graphics companies and suing property owners, which is also something new. But I wanted to see what your opinion was on that.
Well, I'm not generally a fan of hyper-criminalization of everything, and I think this, you know, once you start taking it down this route, well, what's to stop from taking anything that is now being civilly sanctioned and arresting everyone? That does raise certain concerns from just government enforcement, the fact that it's being done in a way that's maybe haphazard and not being applied to everyone equally. That certainly raises concerns for me. Just from a civil libertarian point of view, I'd be concerned. I can certainly respect the idea of the fact that these laws need to be enforced. There are these illegal billboards out there, and it is, you know, considering, you know, the law should matter, the question is, why aren't these laws being enforced? So I can understand the frustration and perhaps the support that the district attorney is receiving because people are frustrated with the lack of enforcement. But I'm not sure going hyper-criminal and setting large bails is necessarily the way to do that. I mean, it probably makes more of a political statement than anything. That'd be my own personal concern. I mean, raises due process concerns too, in terms of just the fairness. Once you start elevating sanctions to the criminal level, you're talking about real jail time, and you're talking about really taking people's rights. So, well, how are you going to arrest the corporation? You know, who do you arrest? Is it the CEO only? Is it everybody on the board? How do you allocate blame? And when one of the fundamental problems with corporation. Well, yeah, but then that would be all of us. And to some level, most of us work for corporations. And if we're going to be held liable for everything our corporation does, then many of us should end up in jail too. And I certainly wouldn't want to support that. So, but that's one of the problems with the notion of the corporation.
Do you think it's a reply to the amount of lawsuits that are happening by corporations towards the city? And so the city is replying with arrests.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, sending a strong message to them, perhaps, hey, cease and desist with the litigation, and maybe we'll lighten up on the... But you know, is that the proper role, the government to be responding to people vindicating their legal rights through the legal system by arresting them? That troubles me a little bit.
Rick, did you have a... Like, what is the answer to this litigation?
I'm not the attorney, but I appreciate his point of view. I think this city has a lot of other major issues. You know, the word urban blight comes up often, and to me, urban blight is our 50% failure rate in our public schools. It's losing 15% of our fire department. It's laying off 1,000 city workers. You know, the timing seems just motivated by more than just illegal billboards, but I think you covered it quite well.
Yes. So hold on one second for the mic.
Hi, I just wanted to say, as an urban warrior against billboards for so many years, even when we have very small victories, the signs don't come down. But it's very interesting that after this guy pulled his heels in jail for the weekend, all of the illegal fuel signs came down all over the city. And they fought Lehigh Lawrence Tribe before the Ninth Circuit. And the city has won on every level, and they wouldn't take them down. But suddenly, that guy pulled his heels in jail. But I wanted to just give you one example of why many of us cheered the arrest and the bail. There was a huge, huge billboard that was proposed in Koreatown on the consulate, and it was a video, not even a digital, but a video on New Hampshire and Wilshire, a hugely dense area and busy and a metro stop, many, many pedestrians. And people argued the safety of it and all. There were five of us who argued against it, and a room filled with lobbyists, attorneys, the Korean community, the mayor's office, the city council office. And we were thunderstruck because when the Building and Safety Commission argued the case, they didn't take it under advisement. They discussed it right there, and we won, 5-0. Within a couple of weeks, Councilman Wesson designated that area as a sign district. So He absolutely nullified everything that we had won. And we've been through this. I can cite chapter and verse of case after case. We just won three really important cases before the appeal thing. They're still up. They'll be up. My grandchildren will be 100, and they'll still be up. So, you know, when we cheer Nooch for arresting this guy and putting this big bail, it's because we are so limited. There's so much money. They make $100,000 a month at least on these big super graphics. And the fire captain said at the federal court, I think Christine was there, that he said, this is a tragedy waiting to happen. They cover windows with vinyl. And he said, as soon as there's a fire there, number one, the vinyl is not fireproof. But he said, the firemen can't get through, the tenants are at risk, and the fire personnel are at risk. So when you talk about, you know, safety and our poor firemen, then you need to worry about the super graphics. Thank you.
I'd like to respond to that.
Yeah.
I think I appreciate your concern, but I think that to summarize all walls as dangerous from a fire point of view just isn't accurate. You know, the adhesive vinyl clear focus that's applied directly to the windows has been approved by the fire department. It's a 3M-backed product, and it's fine. Some of the mesh vinyl on some of the locations, you know, is in question. I also spoke to a fire department captain and said it was no problem. So this is what happens. There's very strong points of view in opposite directions. You know, and it may be a situation, well, you know, money makes our world go around. Like it or not, we're in a capitalist society.
Yes, but Rick, the capitalist society claims that property relations and the rule of law must apply. And what you've just shown us is that property relations and the rule of law are not applying, actually. And tragically, this criminalization, which, like John, I oppose, has actually raised the contradictions to a level of visibility where something's changing. What that suggests to me, and I don't know how legal this would be, is that there needs to be a moratorium on the entire process. A moratorium where all the contradictions that you're experiencing, where you get one answer in West Hollywood, another answer in the city, and within the city itself lots of disparate answers, the thing you're experiencing, which is basically politicians who may not be themselves corrupt, I'm not suggesting they are, but who clearly are bought, like all politicians in the United States essentially are, by the interests that fund them, where speech may be free, but it's too costly for most of us to exercise. Right? Where all these people have to get together in a room and actually discuss these issues in the context of the safety questions, whether it's with the highway administration of the federal government or of the state government, whether it's the fire captains and those involved in the newer technologies for the super graphics, and community activists and interests, so that there can actually be a serious exchange of views and we can try to roll back what's clearly been a bad set of decisions.
I was wondering, a lot of the arguments is about money and whether the government makes a percentage from these billboards, or how much does the city of L.A. make from outdoor advertising?
Not enough to have enough inspectors. You know, and I don't think, I don't really think that the, you know, I don't know, I'm not going to speak for Clear Channel and everybody else. I do know that, citing the West Hollywood example, which is a separate jurisdiction, you know, they did monetize it and allow them to manage it. And, you know, they've had a very good outcome. I've seen it in other markets as well. You know, here, I don't know, it's like the Hatfield and the McCoys. You know, everybody has a long history of animosity. And they, you can start getting into it, and they have different points of view. And I don't know. You know, I don't have an answer for how the harmony will come. I know more and more people want it. You know, I'd rather not see you agitated, and I'd rather not be agitated by your opinions. But here we are. We're in a free country, and off we go.
Okay, let's... okay, how about up here?
One, I have driven the Santa Ana, and if you have gone there at night by the Citadel, it is very clear that you are virtually blinded by the bombardment of all of that visual. It's make sure you have that experience. Do it at night, going north. Now, the other point is, it seems to me the five of you, because you represent different points of view and you're rational, I would say, ask you, get together and proactively create a program which you offer to the city council as a possible way incorporating all of these issues into something that they can handle, because they are lost. You can see what's happening, the quality of the cuts. They just shut the Watts Art Center down. Now, how stupid can you be? I mean, the level of where the cuts are, because I've been attending the Budget and Finance Committee meetings. Parks, libraries, cultural events, they're mad. They really are a problem to us. But
okay.
You may
okay.
have a
problem. Let's focus. Okay. I agree. So, any reply? All right. Let's just take another comment. Do you, how about up on the top row?
Thank you. Good evening. I represent the Social and Public Art Resource Center. We're a community-based public arts organization. Upon reviewing the sign ordinance policy for the city and approaching cultural affairs regarding creating a public art mural in the city of Los Angeles, we were told that because of the billboard abatement policy, that murals fall under this moratorium, this abatement. I was told through an email by the Cultural Affairs Department of Los Angeles that murals are prohibited in the city until the city government can determine whether or not this public form of expression, this legacy of muralism in our city, can continue. Do you have any comments or insight on why murals
yeah.
would be considered a form of advertisement and are prohibited in the city of Los Angeles?
That our visual panel on April 15th was going to address that specifically, but I've been thinking about that particular one and looking at some things, some ads that have no words on them, and they just have an image, that it is very difficult through language to precisely identify what is ad and what is art in a very broad term. And if you try it as an exercise yourself, you can go to the intention or the resume of the artist, or there are methods, but to try to write that into law is another, and I think Warhol and his soup cans is a way for you to look at how complicated is that a Campbell soup thing, or is that a painting by an artist? And the issue is older than Warhol, but it is complicated, and there is a moratorium for everyone to know that there are no murals until the issue has been resolved.
I comment on that. I have some personal experience with cultural affairs on this issue. I think it's tragic that the baby's out with the bathwater on this, but that's just how it was dealt with. From 97 to 2000, I sat on a task force run by Al Nodal, the Super Graphics Task Force. We went every Thursday, one Thursday a month for almost 3 years, writing a code and putting something together that was brought to City Council and thrown in committee, and it's been there ever since. So there have been attempts made.
Well, I mean, let me just add, this is a fundamental problem, sort of going to the definition of what is art, right? I mean, if you look at the history of the modernist art movement, you look at Marcel Duchamp bringing the urinal into the gallery, I mean, the idea is art is in the eye of the beholder. So, you know, what one man's mural is another man's corporate advertisement of some sort. I mean, they could argue. And frankly, if you create an exemption for murals, one of the problems then becomes, well, corporations are then incentivized to muralize their work, right? And advertising of all sorts has gotten increasingly experimental and ambiguous. Sometimes it's hard to tell what product is even being advertised in a particular advertisement. So at the same time, you know, do you want courts involved in the process of aesthetic judgments, deciding what is art and what isn't? Because effectively, that's what they would have to do. Do you want a whole bunch of, have you guys met judges before? You want them deciding what's art? I don't know, but that's the risk you take. And then what test do you use, right? Is it based on the artist's intent? Is it what the average layperson perceives as art? Is it art because it sells as art? Or is that a commercializing definition of art? Is it art because someone says it's art? Who's the person? Who's going to decide? I mean, there ends up being it just ends up becoming a deeply problematic issue. Again, I'm very sympathetic to that problem, though, because this does suggest that one other side, if you're thinking about cultural values, the ban on billboards can impact the cultural history of muralization and negatively. And that's certainly something that adds to the flavor of the city and is an important part of social expression.
We do, though, have a complicated but reasonably settled body of law, don't we, about erotica versus obscenity, which is partly to do with what the average reasonable person would think, but is often also determined as a consequence of expert witness testimony. And yes, judges often are very important people in deciding cases, obviously.
Absolutely.
But expert witnesses are as well. There's a famous moment in the Lady Chatterley trial. Any D.H. Lawrence fans in the audience? Right.
In the library.
Oh, right, we're in the library. Okay.
We're
among friends.
Issue.
There's this dirty book called Lady where people do disgusting things to one another and talk about it. But anyway, Penguin Books was sued by the British Post Office in the late 50s, early 60s, and there was a case where a number of notable people in cultural studies like Raymond Williams and Richard Hoggart gave evidence, and one of the things that Hoggart said was that when he got off the bus in order to make his way to the law courts that morning, he'd heard some guys on a building site using the same words that he'd read in Lady Chatterley's Lover and that Penguin Books was being taken to trial for. And he tried to distinguish between those different uses of the words and tried to indicate that these might be very ordinary parts of life, but also then talked about the notion of, for example, there being something about the intention of corporate forms of eroticism being about trying to elicit immediate, uncontrolled, visceral, bodily desires in viewers that was different from what artists were doing. And that distinction is something that lots of courts have accepted at lots of times and places.
Right? Yeah.
Argue for something similar with Diego Rivera, right, versus Clear Channel. Clear Channel, people who wouldn't allow you, remember, to listen to Bridge Over Troubled Water after September 11th, 2001, because it might make you into a terrorist sympathiser. So we know they're the real defenders of free speech.
Right. Yeah, I would. Good points there, but one of the problems with the obscenity, I mean, I think the obscenity laws are an abomination, and the way they've been enforced has been incredibly selective. They've been enforced, to the socioeconomically disadvantaged, defining things as obscenity, and frankly, the standard of "I know it when I see it" is ridiculous when you're throwing people in jail for decades at a time. It violates due process, and frankly, I think that area of law, if anything, suggests that we should have courts stay far away from making these kinds of judgments as much as possible. So,
I would want to say something, though. I would say go paint that mural anyway. None of us in this room will complain.
Okay, let's go here. Front row.
Just a very quick follow-up to this. Isn't the issue of intent actually a key concept in the law? And couldn't that be the thing which would distinguish whether or not the sign was an advertisement or a piece of art?
That's a great question. Intent is very important, more so in criminal law than it is in civil law. And frankly, I think it's very problematic in civil law because, again, how do you ascertain intent? You know, and when it's a corporation, who are you going to attribute the intent to? I mean, criminal law deals with individuals usually, right? And you're sending someone to jail, so you're ascertaining one person's state of mind. Well, what if you're dealing with a collective entity? How do you attribute a state of mind to a collective entity and what that collective entity's intent was?
The intent is to sell.
Well, it's to sell, but it may also be something else.
Successful in many ways, so there's precedent and there's ways to do it.
Yeah, but there are plenty of cases where, you know, I mean, not that I want to rally to the defense of Two Live Crew, but they were banned as obscene for, you know, a bunch of hip-hop songs in parts of Florida. And, you know, I mean, to me, that smacks of blatant First Amendment violation. Yet, according to the community standards of some rural area in Florida, it probably was obscene to those people. And under the existing standard, that meant these guys go to jail if they performed their works in that area of Florida. So, I mean, Mapplethorpe got out just barely. The very fact that Mapplethorpe had to defend himself or his estate had to defend him in court just to have the right to exhibit a bunch of photographs to me is absurd, and have to incur hundreds of thousands of dollars in potential liability, pay for his attorneys. And by the way, only Mapplethorpe's going to be able to finance that kind of fight. A lesser-known artist isn't going to be able to finance that type of fight when you're going against a very well-funded government that can bring the hammer of the law on you. The odds are rigged against you, and the very fact that you have to go against and make that kind of fight, I think, squelches speech dramatically. Because, you know, when was the last time we saw a Mapplethorpe-like exhibit? 1986, probably.
Okay, we just have, you know, maybe one more question. So how about over here?
My question is for, I don't know your name, but the McDonald representative. So I know one of the examples of kind of billboards or advertisements that you showed in your slideshow was the super graphics on buildings. And I think the issue with, for me personally, and I think other people might feel the same way with things like that, are that tenants in a building, for example, don't have a choice. And I think it's a question of choice of participating in an advertisement in a graphic that actively creates profit for a company. You don't have a choice to participate in it or not. And I don't think it's fair to say, well, if you don't like it, like, leave that building. I don't think that's like a feasible answer. Also, I think it wasn't one of your examples, but I think wraparound bus advertisements are along the same vein. People don't have a choice to participate in the advertisement that creates profit or not. There's no choice. So I'm just wondering how, like, you or your peers would address such a concern that people would have, because I think it also kind of it's going in the direction of, like, I think it was biometrics, I think it was called, where it's like people don't have a choice anymore. And how do you address those concerns of people choosing?
Well, we believe in advertising. We think outdoor has a right, a place, and a purpose. And, you know, I mean, where does that choice stop? Where does that begin or end? I mean, I don't really know how to answer it. You know, I mean, it's the property owner owns the property. In that case, that wall has a right to be there and is going through the legislative process. And, you know, it'd be just like if you work at a company and they put up a billboard in the parking lot and that's a legal billboard, and you have to look at it, but you also have to look at what color they paint their truck and how they landscape their lawn, or whether or not they even paint the building at all. What if the building is in total disrepair and being ignored? Maybe I don't want that choice, and I don't want to look at that. I mean, you know, to me, you know, there's a place for outdoor advertising in commercial zones in big cities. It's part of who we are. Big visual communication to communicate products and ideas and politics has been around from the beginning of time. And, you know, if you don't like looking at it, I don't really know how to answer it.
I know I don't have the mic anymore, but it's not like a question of aesthetics that we've talked about before, but it's a question of participating in someone else's profit.
We all participate in every company's profit. You participate in Coke's profit by buying it and looking at the can. I mean,
that's a choice.
Sure. Well, then I guess we would remove all advertising from all of television and all print and all everywhere in order to eliminate the need to make that choice.
All right, Louise, can we keep going, or how are we? Okay, how about right behind you? Yeah.
I might be able to answer part of the question that she has. I worked for an outdoor company for about 10 years that handles the transit on the buses. The MTA has about 4,000 buses, 3 ads per bus. That's about 12,000 ads on it. The MTA leases out that space to a billboard company for a period of about 5 years. Part of the agreement is that they receive 60% of all the revenue. That's a lot of money, considering you have an average billboard costing $500 per side. So you multiply that, 60% is a lot of money. That money goes back to the MTA, which in turn uses it towards the people. So the people in the bus do share in the profit that is made. Now, that also applies now to the new rail system that has approximately 10 billboards per rail cars. So the MTA does make money, and that money goes back to the people. I don't know how much money is made on billboards, maybe Rick knows, but as far as transit, there is a lot of money to be made, and it does go back to the MTA. 60% of it does, because that's part of the agreement. That's
all right. Okay, so I think what we need is another panel. So it does, I feel like we've got to air the issues and really see, you know, the different sides. And I appreciate that people said it quite civilly, as Louise recommended. So it is complicated. So I think we have been polarized into the two positions, but I feel like I'm beginning to understand the complications of it, and that we so on April 15th, I think it's 7:30 in the evening at SIARC, which is in the neighborhood, that we're going to talk about it again from the visual perspective. And I welcome you to join us. And there are a few websites that if you want to find out more about this, I recommend scenic.org, the OAAA, which is Outdoor Advertising
Association
of America, OAAA.org. KCT has a really great video up on their website. And then the anti-advertising group is called BannBillboardBlight.org, and they have their different arguments about safety and visual clutter, etc. So thank you very, very much for coming, and I appreciate Mac Center and the library for figuring this all out. Thank you. Bye.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC, 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.